assured them of it.
Chris is going into this
incredibly mundane detail.
Go.
Really?
They kind of move on.
See, there must be a gavel here somewhere.
Oh, they didn't put it out. So, it's bad when you have to move on.
Yes, that's not
a gavel. I just said that. Open.
Oh, my God, that's the worst.
He's just driving me crazy. I look at this and I'm like, oh, my God.
This is Monday, January 28th, 2013, and we are the Committee on Health and Human Services Housing Policy. Welcome. We have an agenda today for confirmations. We're going to begin with two agencies, the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency and the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board. And following those, we will move into affirming our two commissioners. So with that, we're going to begin with the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency public members. Just to orient the committee, the Minnesota Housing Agency is the state's affordable housing institution. It was first developed in 1971 and has been an establishment since then. They are an organization that provides and supports successful home ownership. They preserve federally subsidized rental housing. They address specific and critical needs of the rental housing markets. They prevent and end homelessness and prevent foreclosures and support community reinvestment and recovery. Last year, this organization spent $658 million in 2012 for housing needs. They are an alliance, I think this is important to understand, between government, private sector, nonprofit, and faith-based communities. And they are very focused and interested in working on issues around the affordability of housing. So with that background to understand what it is that we are doing in terms of confirmations, I will invite Stephanie Klingzing to the desk. Stephanie will be presenting. Stephanie, would you orient me? Are you presenting for all of the persons whose names are here?
Madam Chair, I am.
Thank you very much.
As you can see from the list of the board members for the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, there are a lot of Johnsons. It's Mr. Steve Johnson, Mr. Joe Johnson, and Mr. Ken Johnson. I am not a Johnson. I am a Klingzing.
Well, is that a requirement? Is that do you get an extra point?
I wondered about that. Exactly. But thank you for inviting me. Yes, the other members were not able to attend today.
Well, thank you and welcome. Let me just say, Stephanie, before you begin, Joseph Johnson III is a newly, absolutely newly reappointed member. And will not be included in the names that we confirm today, but because it hasn't gone through the process enough for to come back and ask for our confirmation. So just for the orientation of our committee members, we'll be talking about the others whose names are here, who we will introduce. So please, with that, go ahead and present, Ms. Klingzing.
What I came here to say and to testify to is that I've been now on the Housing Finance Agency Board. This is my third year. And have been involved in housing on really the grassroots level for a very long time as County Commissioner of Sherburne County, also here actually in the House of Representatives, on the housing committee, and then as 12 years as mayor of the city of Elk River, very involved in housing and affordable housing, and also ran a transitional housing program in my area of Sherburne County. I bring that to the board, and I believe that when I was nominated by several of the housing nonprofit and public agencies here in Minnesota to serve on the board, my grassroots understanding, what's on the ground, how is the housing issues affording helping people really where they live, you know, if I can say that. But that's not the case for all of the housing finance agency members. They are people that have been involved in finance, in public finance, private finance. They've been involved in housing on the nonprofit area. I can tell you that the mix that we have on the board now is excellent. We definitely have people who understand the intricacies and the complex issues of bonding. We have people who understand budgeting. I'm one of them that understands taxes and how that affects people on the ground. But I think we have a great mix. I think the governor has made some very wise decisions in nominating the people and then having the Senate confirm the ones who are sitting on the board right now. We work with a wonderful commissioner. We just went through an evaluation for her and her position last week, and she received very high marks from us, mostly because she definitely is interested in affordable housing. She understands where the costs are, where the cost savings are, but how to take all of that and put it together and make it a workable agency for the people that we serve and also, of course, for the state of Minnesota. So I just wanted to testify to the fact that I believe the board is an excellent board. We have an excellent commissioner. And we know what our duties are. I don't think anybody is misunderstanding the fact that the board actually is the agency that has the oversight and the running of the agency. The commissioner obviously serves at the discretion of the governor, and she also is the one that runs the staff. But we are not a rubber stamp committee. I think she'd be the first one to tell you that that's the case. We look at things, we scrutinize things, we question things. And then when we come out with a decision, I believe we've made some very good ones with, obviously, the commissioner's help and the wonderful staff that we have there. So thank you for inviting me, and let's open it to questions.
Thank you, Ms. Klinzing. When the appointments are made for the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, is there a geographic distribution as well as a look at these various mission statements that you have here about areas that you're focusing on to make certain that the representation represents the various areas of your work?
That's right, yes. First of all, I think geographically, very, very important. In fact, there was a member that was asked to be dismissed just recently because they found out that the area that she lived in was not an area that the governor was interested in seeing, an equalization across the state. Definitely that is true. I do believe that there is an emphasis on areas that we have come from, whether we have served in the nonprofit area in housing, whether we've served in the public area, whether they've been policymakers, business people, that sort of thing. I think that they are looking for a mix of that, and right now we have an excellent mix.
Okay, thank you. We are considering the confirmation of Stephanie Klinzing, Gloria Bostrom, John DeKramer, Stephen Johnson, and Kenneth Johnson today. And with that, I wanted to read their names into the record. Would anybody like to ask some questions? So then, would somebody like to make a motion to move that this committee recommend the appointment of these persons that I've just named as members of the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency and that they be confirmed? Is that Senator Hayden? Senator Hayden moves that we recommend the appointment of, I'll say the names again, Stephanie Klinzing, Gloria Bostrom, John DeKramer, Stephen Johnson, and Kenneth Johnson. Is there any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
It's an honor to serve in this way.
Yes. Thank you for your service and thank the others as well. So the next is the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board. And Jennifer DeShane and Matthew Simpson, I think, are here to present. So just to orient the committee, the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board is the lead agency for emergency medical services in Minnesota. The Emergency Medical Service Regulatory Board is the state's agency that's responsible for licensing ambulance services, certifying emergency medical personnel, approving emergency medical services training programs, designating and funding 8 regional EMS organizations that support emergency medical services, and administering the Volunteer Ambulance Training Project, the Longevity Program for Volunteer Ambulance Personnel, and the EMS for Children Grant Program. Thank you. And with that, I will turn the table over to you. Would you please say your names into the record before you present?
Madam Chair, I'm Jennifer DeShane, and I have been on the EMSRB, the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board, for a year and a half. And I am glad to be here today for the official confirmation. I represent public health in the state of Minnesota. Public health has always had a strong relationship with emergency medical services, the pre-hospital care, and the access to health care. And I have a background in public health and nursing as well as emergency medical services. I have just renewed my emergency medical technician certification for the 17th time. I have worked as an ambulance director for a rural ambulance. I've worked in the metro area. I was president of Minnesota Ambulance Association at one time, and I also was state EMS director at the Department of Health for 3 years. I also am part of education in EMS. I am one of the instructors at Hennepin Tech for the new community paramedic program that was approved last year and has been very successful. Our Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board has a wide variety of members, and I think we have a very solid regulatory board that we are setting up our goals and strategies and moving forward. There's diversity on the group. There's a good mix of male and female and good representation from different disciplines that are committed to emergency medical services.
I am Matt Simpson. I represent the fire chiefs for the state of Minnesota, and this is my second term. Again, sharing in Jennifer's purpose on the board is to make sure that citizens of Minnesota receive the best medical care and the best direction for providing those services, from whether it's a paid service all the way down to the volunteer service. It's basically for the citizens of Minnesota, and I think this is a great honor to represent both the fire chiefs in that manner as well as the citizens of Minnesota. And I don't guess I need to go into further explanation of what the board does. She did a very nice job of that, but that's thanks for having us here today.
Thank you. This is an 18-member, one vacant seat board. You have 3.5 to 4-year terms, depending on when you're appointed, and those terms of the members that we're looking at today are through either the January 5th, 15, or through January 4th, 16, for some of the other members. May I ask you, what would you say is, as you work on the board, is the most critical issue or two facing emergency medical services in the state of Minnesota? As a board, what are you seeing, and what trends are bring concern to you that we should know in the legislature?
Well, I think education standards, for one, to make sure that we are pushing forward with the correct, most current education standards for our paramedics, EMTs, and first responders within the state of Minnesota. I personally sit on the complaint review panel. I chair that panel. So that we can deal appropriately and effectively with any concerns that might come up with the staff throughout the state of Minnesota of those responders and deal with them effectively. That would be my impression.
Madam Chair, committee, I
and
also...
Your name, say your name, add your name.
Jennifer DeShane.
Thank you.
I also think that support for the volunteer rural services is very important. They always have struggled in outstate to maintain volunteers. It is getting more difficult in some areas. Making sure that they have the support, technical assistance, the correct educational opportunities to maintain their skills. I think both making sure that that's available to them through the emergency medical services metro regions, and also through our regulation and support to maintain those services in outstate. We focus also on the metro area services. They tend to also help support those volunteer services in many ways through education and leadership.
I don't want the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency to feel bad because I didn't ask them any questions, but they did make a presentation in front of the committee. So yeah, I'm not picking on you. But I'm interested to know, and you began to speak a little bit about, Mr. Shane, about the volunteer system and the rural access to quality emergency services. I would be interested to know, I am a rural representative, and whether or not you have adequate timing and response and able to get to critical access hospitals or emergency room services. Is the system of trauma centers working? Are the communications effective? How are you seeing things, and what are you discussing about that in your committee?
Madam Chair, Jennifer DeShane, we have been very progressive in the trauma system. And I think the trauma system is very supportive in helping with that access. Also with looking at the automatic electronic defibrillator system and the education around that, the education around CPR for all citizens, that's very effective in outstate as well. And also as part of the statute and regulations in 144E to make sure that the volunteer ambulance services are meeting the response times and being able to access the level of health care that they need to get their citizens to. So we do have consultants in each different regions of the state that do review those runs with those ambulance services and also give them some feedback and input and connect them to some education to help improve that.
Thank you. This may be, are there others? May I just finish, and then Senator Rosen has a question as well. When you're meeting, you're reviewing these objectives that you're needing to achieve, and you're evaluating your outcomes and making suggestions, who are you directing? Who are you giving guidance to?
Madam Chair, Jennifer DeShane again. It is to the each service has an ambulance director and a medical director, as well as their volunteers. So the information is directed to the leadership, but it's also passed on to the volunteers themselves. There's opportunity for them to engage with those consultants and to ask questions and help identify some alternatives to help the services.
Thank you. Senator Rosen.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And I would, first of all, like to just do a shout-out for this board. I think they've done a tremendous job with being flexible and being very nimble with the issues that are facing all of Minnesota. And you look at who's on the board, 18-member board, you've reacted very quickly. And I probably should have you do some testimony for the community paramedic bill that's going to be coming up Wednesday, hopefully in your committee on this Wednesday. But that is a very good example how you were able to make that work, first in the nation. And actually, we developed it for greater Minnesota, but apparently and obviously it's working for some of the big trauma centers and some of the other areas in the metro. So I want to thank you for that. I do serve a very large rural district, and what I'm hearing from our volunteer firefighters is the critical issue is the aging. That the firefighters are older, the folks, there's not these firefighters that are coming up that are younger and able to take on this commitment, and that's what it is. It's a commitment, and I'm just wondering if you've dealt with that in your board meetings and any ideas of what's going to happen. I mean, it's getting to be at a critical mass here.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, and members of the committee, some of the retention subjects have crossed our tables, and there are for the rural areas specifically, we have rural ambulance assessments to help identify some of those abilities and suggestions to help with that retention and education. I think it all stems down to giving and explaining ideas to the different communities on how to make things work to better, you know, make it a more attractive position, if you will. And I think so through those ideas, not to give any specifics at this point based on a specific area of Minnesota, but there's just some practices that we can suggest. What makes this job exciting? What makes it rewarding? And I think that's, if you sell that to the people that are going to replace the retirements or whatever, I think that's an exciting opportunity that they do end up realizing through that educational opportunity and serving their community. And I think that's what it all stems down to.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Mr. Simpson and Ms. DeShane, for that, too. And again, I want to thank you for your work on the board. I think the EMS board has done a tremendous job. Just a little briefing to some of the metro area legislators around the table that it's really something to see a volunteer firefighting community from a certain town support all these other communities when there's some kind of disaster. And we've had the floods and we've had the tornadoes, and I'll never forget one particular instance where it was in Truman and they had a terrible flood down there, and the folks, the volunteer firefighters from Henderson came all the way down with their equipment, set it up, and it is really something to see these folks pull together. And it doesn't matter how far the distance is and how much it's going to cost and what's going on, they pull together, and that's what really makes living out in Greater Minnesota, I think, just enchanting, because there is a community feel, and you guys are a part of it. So just a little thank you.
That's from all of us. Anything further that you'd like to? Yes.
Madam Chair, Jennifer DeShane, I just wanted to say that I know that everybody on the board feels very, very passionate about what they do, and they do support each other in best practices. And even though we are a regulatory board, we also have at our heart the passion to support the volunteers and the even the private and not-for-profit in the metro area, but all the individuals that provide emergency medical services and the medical directors that do a lot of work and sacrifice a lot of time to help support these individuals. And it's a very passionate group, and that, I think, makes us a group that really moves forward together.
Thank you. Senator Rosen, would you like to make a motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I certainly would. I would so move that the members from the EMS, the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board, Dr. Mari Thomas, Ms. Jill Ryan Schultz, got to get my glasses on, Kelly Pratt, Mrs. DeShane, Mr. Simpson, Elizabeth Concy, Steve DeShean, Dr. Paula Fink-Cocken, and Dr. Paul Satterley be recommended to pass and be confirmed. Be recommended for confirmation.
Did we say your names?
Yes.
Yes, okay. Yes, that the committee recommends that these names recommended as members of the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board be confirmed. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Hearing none. Congratulations and thank you.
Thank you
very much.
All right. And now we're going to move on to the confirmation hearing for Commissioner Lucinda Jessen from the Department of Human Services. Welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very, very much for coming. I think that we'll begin by offering you the microphone to talk a little bit about yourself, about DHS, about your goals, and I hope that in the course of the time that you talk, you'll speak to one question that I have, and that is what in your own nature, your own life, your own experience caused you to pursue this as a part of a certain time in your life to be this commissioner? What is it about that that was attractive to you, given all the options that you would have with your background in your life?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am Lucinda Jessen, and for the past 2 years, it has been my privilege to serve in Governor Dayton's administration as the Commissioner of Human Services. Now, I first want to thank Governor Dayton for this honor and privilege. You know, I did not know the governor before the transition and recount period, and I came to know him during that transition period. I came to know him as a man of principle, a man who truly cares about people, who has this boundless ability for hard work and attention to detail, but always while keeping the big picture in mind. And to answer your question, you know, Madam Chair, I didn't, you know, set out actually to become Commissioner of Human Services. I was working on the transition while I was a professor at Hamline. I have kind of a background as a lawyer, as many of you all know, sometime in public practice, sometime in private practice. But you know, I've always had a passion for human services and healthcare. As a matter of fact, one of my first jobs when I was in the State Attorney General's office was to represent the Department of Human Services. And kind of my passion for the people that we serve there, for the most vulnerable in our society, for making sure that we provide opportunities for people that kind of really, you know, ladder up wherever possible has always been at the heart of, you know, my work, not just as a lawyer, but as, you know, in my church, in my community. And when I came to know the governor and he asked me to take this position, I could not, you know, while it wasn't something I had anticipated, I must say, Madam Chair, it just, you know, really reached at the heart of what I hope to be able to try and do with my life, which is to really help those most in need, to do it while serving the taxpayers well, and to do it working with and for a governor who I really respect. I must also say, though, in addition to thanking the governor, I must thank my husband. My taking this job was somewhat of a surprise to him, I would say, and he has had such patience, good advice through the past 2 years, and more than anything, though, it helps me when I've had a long day, or last week, like when I came home and had a long day, dealt with the budget and wasn't feeling so well, and I come home and he looks at me and says, I think I'll cook dinner tonight. I'll make your favorite dinner. So I really appreciate his support. And certainly our employees. I work with such an amazing, dedicated group of employees at the department. You know, sometimes people will say, Cindy, you have a hard job. And I think these are not people who've ever actually watched one of our security counselors at Security Hospital do their jobs. If they think I have a hard job, they haven't watched and worked the work of the nurses who work in Anoka Regional Treatment Center. And those are just some examples of the really dedicated work our employees do. On a day-to-day basis. So I feel it's been a real privilege, Madam Chair and members, to work with them. But having said that, I think that we all have to admit, and when I say all of us, those of you who've worked in human services and been parts of these committees, certainly our county partners, these last 2 years have been a challenge for those of us who work in human services. I mean, though we're coming out of a bit, these have been very difficult economic times. You know, times where more people turn to our programs. We have over 100,000 more families and children on our Medicaid program than we did at the beginning of the recession. More people turning to our programs because of the difficult economic times, and yet at the same time, historic budget deficits when policymakers logically look to the largest state agency and say, what can we cut? And so in this environment, my approach has been that we cannot simply debate what to preserve and what to cut. So we have to look at every option to do things, to see where can we do things differently, where can we make changes, where can we truly have reform. I think that was true 2 years ago, but I must say it is also just as true today. So I want to, and I think that's true because our programs are the safety net that most Minnesotans, I think across county party lines, count on their government to provide. To help, just to tell a few stories, because I've spent a lot of time in my job traveling around Minnesota, but to help the young man I met just last November at an adoption event. He was adopted when he was 14 years old after just multiple foster care placements. And I talked to him and to his adoptive parents You know, the first few years were hard after being adopted. But with the support of his family and some of the support of our services, he graduated from high school. He lettered in football and wrestling and track, and he now is attending a technical college. And our programs are there, and they exist to help another young man I met just this fall as well. And this is a young man with developmental disability, and he had lived in an adult foster care, which is, of course, very appropriate for many people. But for him, it wasn't. It was a place where even to request to purchase a protein bar required a doctor's approval. Well, through our Housing Access Services programs, which we, you know, work closely with ARC on, he was able to move to his own apartment. And today, far from having to ask permission to buy a protein bar, he's doing his own grocery shopping and learning to cook. And our programs help the middle-aged man I met when I was at one of our workforce centers. I was out there, and I was watching some of the classes for people on our MFIT program. And he was taking a class in interviewing. It's the first time in his life he'd ever had to turn, or anyone in his family had ever had to turn to assistance. So I'm there, and because I've interviewed for quite a few jobs, for better or for worse, I was giving him some interview tips, and he said, "You don't understand. I work construction. I've never had to interview for a job before." You know, and I think these are just a few faces of human services and a few of the million people that we serve every year. People who I think, along with taxpayers, frankly, count on us to do more than just preserve the status quo, but to do a better job. So I'm not going to go through all the things that we have done. There is a list of, I think, the 2012 accomplishments in there. There's also, if you want, on our website, a list of 2011 accomplishments. But I just do want to hit a few things that I think are indicative of how we've tried to reform our human services going forward. And when we started with reforming our managed care contracts. Why? Well, for one thing, that's where a huge amount of dollars were being spent. But by putting those largest contracts out for bid and then applying the rate cuts that we were able to receive, and by applying those across the state, we save taxpayers hundreds of millions of dollars in this biennium, and those are savings that will be carried forward. And I think it was largely due to these savings that we were able to, despite the historic budget deficit, preserve eligibility for people on our programs. But we also negotiated a 1% cap on the 2011 contracts we inherited, managed care contracts that we inherited from the previous administration, so that last year we collected an additional $70 million for taxpayers. But not only that, in the 2011 budget agreement, we agreed to place caps on managed care contracts going forward. And I was a part of that because I think that we need to set different expectations about how much we are willing to spend as a state. Yet last month, when we negotiated the contract rates for 2013, we came in far below of that 2% cap that we had agreed to. So if you think about it, those of you who, and I know I used to be a small business owner, I have to, you know, pay for health insurance, and only 2% increase is aggressive when an aggressive goal. But we came in below that and saved taxpayers another $60 million. I must say, I think that kind of the competitive bidding and a number of steps we have taken to try and change our managed care contracting approach and our approach to the plans have received bipartisan support. And I think that's one of the reasons that we have been successful in these efforts. But I must say, while I am all for driving a hard bargain, and I think we've tried to do that for some examples I just used and some others across the last 2 years, I must say that simply paying less for basic care is not going to serve our long-term systemic challenges. What are those long-term systemic challenges? Well, we're living longer, which is a good thing. Our state's growing older. More and more of our seniors and people with disabilities are going to be turning to our Medicaid program. And without some changes, the reforms, those programs would overwhelm any state budget. And that's why we can't just say, here are things we're doing to cut what we're spending, but we need to actually do reform that is going to change our healthcare system going forward. And I mentioned that, and there are a number of ways we're trying to do this, but let me highlight two. And one of them, I know I spoke briefly with this committee about just in the last week or two, and that's our Reform 2020 initiative. And this is our initiative to redesign the fastest growing part of our budget, home and community-based services for the elderly and people with disabilities. You know, this is something that's designed to save money but reinvest that in the system now so that by 2020, when the age wave hits us, we have a more sustainable system, yet one that serves the people that need it. The steps, which focus on consumer direction, more community support, earlier interventions, help during transitions, you know, if we take these, and this, we will have that sustainable long-term care system that we're going to need when the age wave truly hits us. Now, you know, I know many of you all, like me, probably, you know, followed the press around the rollout of the governor's budget. And I must say, Reform 2020 wasn't in any of the headlines. It's never going to be probably, you know, the most emailed story. But this sort of comprehensive redesign, one that I must say came out of the 2011 budget deal and has bipartisan support, this is exactly the sort of hard work of reform which we need to be doing, in which I want to be accountable for as commissioner. But just as paying less But moving on just from Reform 2020, let me move on to why I think we have to do more than just, you know, just pay less. Well, because paying less doesn't get us, better results, though I must say sometimes paying more doesn't get us better results either. And as a state, I think we deserve better health, better health outcomes for the dollars we're spending. And to do that, we really need to make changes to our health care delivery system. So I just wanted to tell you a few things. Excuse me, Madam Chair. That we have started doing the last 2 years, and that I think you can expect us to move forward with in the next 2 years to do this. First, Minnesota was the very first state to have direct contracting with providers, which changes the incentives from doing more to doing better, to keeping people healthy and to be more efficient. Just this month, we have the signed agreements with 6 providers all around our state so that we have, as of this month, 100,000 of our Medicaid enrollees that are receiving care through those providers, providers with new incentives to keep people healthy, to be more efficient. And we'll be adding more. We're in conversations with even more providers. We think this is a cutting-edge way to help change our delivery system and the care people are receiving, to focus more on prevention that we're going to need to do to really have reform in our system. And we're also working much more closely with counties to integrate health and social services so that we can better serve our clients and save taxpayer dollars in the process. Too much we see shifting between the social service systems and our healthcare systems, and we need to be aligned and working together. You know, our innovative work with Hennepin Health is the first example of this. We've had some excellent results after that first year in 2012, but there will be more. We're having more conversations with counties, and it's once again another direction we want to move in. You know, we need to make outcomes and quality the hallmark of our purchasing efforts. And all these are two examples in healthcare and with Hennepin Health, really healthcare and social services. We need to do this not just in healthcare, but childcare and everything in between in human services. And you don't change everything overnight, but we are really starting down that path in a big way. I think you'll see some of that in our budget proposals. You'll see proposals for nursing home increases tied to quality. Introducing a system of quality-based rate increases for home and community-based providers as well. It'll take a little bit to get up and running, but that is, I think, an important way that we should be providing more additional funds, but tied to outcomes to those providers. Our child care increases, in part, are tied to quality programming as measured by our Parent Aware. And we're talking with the health plans who have been, I think, overall supportive of this about reconfiguring our quality measures and the withholds in our largest contracts so that we can put more attention and, frankly, more dollars at risk on the important issue of narrowing healthcare disparities. And these are just some examples. You can look at our move towards more outcome contracting with counties is another example. But this is certainly the direction we have been moving, we want to move to have, I think, better outcomes for our enrollees and better value for taxpayers. You know, and I think this overall approach is reflected in the governor's proposed budget for DHS. That budget is, compared to the November forecast, basically flat, $38 million more dollars. And I know that this is troubling to many individuals and providers who have suffered from a lot of cuts and rate freezes and other things in the past. But I want to say here, you know, and to all of and to everyone, that having a relatively flat budget does not mean this budget represents the status quo. And I think for those of you who've looked at the budget will see that it actually reflects millions in new spending on children, on improvements in our mental health system, two big areas. But it also has millions in reductions and eliminations of programs that are not as critical to our success. It includes Reform 2020, the comprehensive redesign I referred to. And in short, we are really trying to look at how do we reform services so that we provide better care to people within our existing resources while keeping people in their homes and communities and being better stewards of public funds. I mean, that's overall kind of really a lot of my goals the last 2 years and will be a lot of what we focus on moving forward. I would like to point out, I think it's in your materials, in addition to kind of a list of, you know, accomplishments in 2012, I realize it doesn't get at some of them in 2011, which included, for example, Medicaid expansion, which is no small feat. But I think if you look at this, what we call our framework for the future for 2013, you'll see really some of the major things we're focusing on in 2013. Now, we put this document together, probably some of you have seen it, for 2012 as well. Some of these things are, you know, continue from 2012. Some are new. It's not a list of everything we're doing in the department, but I think it highlights some of the key initiatives we want to work on. And I think it also highlights the focus that we put on narrowing the disparities that we see on. And this is really largely through the creation of the Office of Inspector General, which I did as commissioner last year, or 2011. More of a focus on integrity for preventing fraud and abuse, for detecting it and going after those dollars wherever we can, as well as the focus on people, on getting them not only access to insurance, but access to health care and better outcomes. I would note that we have measures that relate to each of these, and that by the end of April, we should be able to go onto our public dashboard. And if some of you all have seen it, one of the things we did in 2011 is have a public dashboard so that people could track how we're doing on major goals, such as narrowing the disparities in out-of-home placement for American Indian children. So you'll be able to look at this framework and then track to the measures that we're using and how we're doing on those measures. And so that kind of transparency and, you know, efforts to make sure that that we are not just setting out lofty goals, but setting out concrete ways to try and achieve them and measuring our success is part of what we're trying to do with the department and certainly is an important goal for me as commissioner. I think as far as ending kind of my more formal remarks, I'd also just want to take an opportunity to thank all of you. I mean, many of you all have been through this the last 2 years with me. You know, and I think that the to make meaningful, sustainable reforms going forward, I think those last longer and are best done where we have bipartisan support for those reforms. I recognize that everyone's not going to agree on you know, major changes, but I think the fact that we have worked across the aisle on so many of these reforms, Reform 2020 being an excellent example, is one of the reasons those reforms are going to be, I believe, the lasting important reforms in the way we deliver human services. So I really appreciate the work and support I've gotten from so many of you. Look forward, I hope, to working with you in the future. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner. We're now open for questions. Are there any questions from Senator Nelson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I think we visited briefly about this earlier, but I'm not sure if I got a total answer. And that has to do with the early childhood quality performance measures, the parent aware. And I understand the governor's budget, the new money, the $150 million, I think maybe a year of new money, is tied to that parent aware. But I want to know what we're doing with the money that we're already spending, I think it's maybe $200 million a year that we're already spending on subsidized child care. And I'd like to know your efforts or the governor's efforts or your thoughts on having some quality measures, parent aware, for that a good deal of money that we're already spending on early childhood.
Commissioner Jessen.
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, thank you very much for that question. I think the $150 million number that people have been talking about has been part of a request made by some early childhood advocates. You know, I think what's in the governor's budget, some about $44 million in the Department of Education's budget for scholarships. In addition, we have about $20 million in the proposed budget for DHS that is to increase to do several things, to increase our basic child care rates, which haven't for two providers, but also to start linking them more directly to quality. We also have an additional sum in the governor's proposed budget to roll out parent aware statewide. Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, you know, I think that your point about trying to tie more of our subsidized child care payments to quality is exactly part of what we're proposing to do in the governor's budget. What we try to do with child care rates is to do a basic increase to where the rates that we pay for subsidized child care are about at the 25% level. So if you think of, if you had like 100 providers in a county and you rated them from the lowest people who paid the least to the paid the most, we'd be at number 25. That's not very high, but we needed to raise the base rates. But we also, on top of that, created greater differentials for providers, both centers and family care providers, that are parent aware rated. So my recollection is that there were small differentials before, but we said, so if you're parent aware rated 3 stars, then we'll pay you 15% more. If you're 4% parent aware rated, four star parent aware rated, which is the highest rating, I believe, we'll pay you 20% more. So, because we wanted to provide incentives to providers to get those, it's training, it's for the ability to provide more quality care, which we think is better for children on our programs and children everywhere. So we wanted to provide incentives to providers. We will pay you more if you are quality rated. And it's also then incentives for parents, too, that are making choices. And so we really are trying to drive more of those child care dollars towards quality providers.
Just a quick follow-up.
Yes, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for the direction that that's moving. I think that's important that we make sure that we give parents that information and then that we make sure that that time is the most effective in preparing kids so they're ready to learn when they enter school. Just one other further question in regards to – so I think you're saying it's the new money, actually, that's leading – going towards the quality rating, not necessarily the existing, which I understand. On another topic right in that area, it's important that we not just think that just the center care is important. It certainly is, but certainly there's high-quality care in home-based settings as well, and I want to make sure that that is still preserved and available.
Commissioner Jessen.
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, I couldn't agree more. And when we roll out Parent Aware statewide, we particularly need to reach out to family daycare providers, make them aware of this, help them in every way we can to access these additional tools. I think that's particularly true in rural Minnesota, and we are very cognizant of that.
Thank you.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Jessen, for being here. I do really appreciate your work, and I think you've done a very good job, and I really appreciate our work that we've done the last 2 years, too, in a very bipartisan way. And I hope that the measures that we take going forward are in a bipartisan way, as you mentioned. I think that's very, very important. Certainly, we couldn't have gotten anything passed last 2 years without it being bipartisan, but I hope that same feeling goes forward with that. And I think what we did on the capping on the managed care, the $60 million in savings, kudos to you and to all to this committee that have worked on that and have done some excellent reforms that we're capturing some of those savings. My question, there's two questions, is the Reform 2020, which I think is just wonderful, but you look at the governor's budget and there is probably, I think I'm up to a dozen federally approved waivers that we have to receive before we can really capture those dollars, but those dollars are being captured in the budget right now. So having a little issue with that, need to know where you're at, if you can. So tell us what your negotiations are with CMS and if they are going to be approved, and if they're not, then what do we go forward on that? And then the second question is, you mentioned there's $38 million over the November forecast. I guess I thought it was over $100 million, $128 million that we're over. So need to have that a little clarified, too, if we could. Commissioner Jessen.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, first of all, thank you for your comments. I've really enjoyed working with you over the last 2 years. Let me address Reform 2020 first and then the budget numbers. What we did in Reform 2020 was to try and, have for every proposal which require waivers, and our spending that goes along with that. So if we get the waivers and we get some additional money and flexibility with the feds, here's how we would spend it. So if, for example, we do not get approval for one thing, we have tied to it the spending that would come out of the budget. So we've tried to be very careful about that. Having said that, we feel optimistic about our ability to get these waivers from the federal government. They're asking us questions now. We're in that phase where we made the presentations. They're asking us questions. They understand the legislative deadlines and our need to get this done. I spoke with Cindy Mann, who's head of Medicaid, about this a week and a half ago. They're committed to working and meeting those deadlines with us. They don't say, oh, we promise we'll approve everything, but they will get decisions made so that we can – that comes into the legislative process. But we've tried to construct this in a way that while we believe we will get these waivers, and I would say that there are a couple of things we asked for in our Reform 2020 package that we were not as optimistic that we would get CMS at least this year to agree to. We didn't put those in the budget. We didn't put those savings in the budget, so we were fairly careful about that. Let me just go to your question about the amount of spending. The $38 million above where we were in the February forecast is, I think, the real number. There were a lot of transactions back and forth. If you look at transactions between funds, some savings that we saved in our budget but that didn't get accounted for in our budget that just were like, oh, no, but we're going to count that over here. We're happy, Senator Rosen and members, to walk you through, why, the proposals we made to the governor to say, okay, governor, here's what we think we can do to have – to address the things we need to do, but to do it within the parameters of our own budget. And that included cuts and savings, but sometimes those cuts and savings don't show up in our budget. Mm-hmm. Some of the work we did with the Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund would be one example of that.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Yeah, Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair. Just a kind of a question. Do the commissioners have to go in front of the budget committee also, or
no.
Just the policy?
Just the policy committee.
Just the policy, okay. Probably we'll need, though, at some point in budget committee to get a little further clarification on my last question.
Yes, legislation moves forward.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there other questions? Senator Benson.
Madam Chair and Commissioner Jessen, I want to thank you. I've had the opportunity to work with you on the governor's task force that built the roadmap, and you were very professional, and even when we disagreed on a policy, you never got political, and so you always were very clear where you stood, but were willing to listen and talk. And I think I've built really good relationships on this side of the aisle, and I appreciate it very much. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator Benson. Senator Nino.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Commissioner. And just again, more of a comment along the lines of Senator Benson rather than a question. No secret to those that follow this committee and these issues that I and the department and even you at times have crossed paths in ways that weren't necessarily completely friendly. But in all of that, I understand that you work for Governor Dayton. Governor Dayton is elected in his own right, and just because I might or might not agree or disagree with a particular policy, shouldn't have a reflection or drive how I'm voting for confirmation. And I've always taken the position that a commissioner should be kind of presumptive, and something has to be a disqualifier, and I've certainly not seen anything of that sort in you. So thank you.
Is there any no? Are there any further questions? Then I have a few questions. As you know, because I attempted to alert you to the fact that there have been some expressed concerns about the measures of the dashboards that have been presented in state-operated services, especially as it relates to the security hospital in St. Peter. And over the last several years, what has been of concern is the increasing amount of injury and overtime and the complex employee relations issues that have been occurring on the St. Peter campus, leaving a number of psychiatrists, a number of concerns from the employees in particular that suggest to them that when you're looking at your framework for the future, that the framework doesn't really address anything that relates to the conditions, the work conditions, the environment in which we place our public employees working with significantly traumatized individuals whose behavior in managing their mental illness is quite aggressive. The outcome of that is a continual. I can tell you, Commissioner Jessen, that it precedes you, that it's at least five of the 6 years that I've been in the legislature prior to this year, this issue, this concern that the employees are not listened to or heard or allowed to participate in effective decision-making, the line staff we're talking about, and that they continue to experience serious injury, serious workman's compensation costs, results in huge overtime costs that distress the budget, that they feel as though the issue is never resolved, it only gets worse. And so when the confirmation hearing became public, we've received a number of communications from the employees to ask you to talk about that and to be confronted by the idea that that as a commissioner that you're not calling upon your agency to raise up the issue of the conditions under which we ask employees to work in very difficult and dangerous situations. And I want to offer you an opportunity to talk about that, talk about the dashboards if you can, and what very specific commitments you're making to these employees about creating a safe environment, not only for patients, but for the people that work with them. And by dashboards, if you're asking me about that, what we talked about in the past is the increasing number of injuries, the increasing numbers of workmen compensated, increasing number of overtime hours to cover all of those costs that really drove a budget deficit in the DHS budget about 3 years ago.
Madam Chair, members.
Commissioner.
I'm happy to address this. I would say, as far as kind of like the importance of this to us going forward, I would refer you to kind of the framework for the future document that I did pass out. And actually, the first bullet says that we need to better protect children and vulnerable adults and families and facilities, especially those directly in our care, which very much goes towards people who we protect and care for in our state-operated services, and especially in security hospital. We will have measures that will be, you know, that we're lining up to figure out how do we measure whether or not we are making improvements, and, you know, addressing the situation at security hospital will be part of that. This framework is more for kind of the outward focus. We also have kind of internal ones as well, which deal more directly with employees and hiring and a number of things that are critical to our success, though, which are not on this document. Having said that, let me just maybe have a few minutes and talk about Security Hospital, which I think is one of the most challenging, it is a challenging facility to run. It's challenging because the clients are challenging. And these and our employees who work there have some of the very hardest jobs in state government. There is absolutely no question about that. You know, I think that when I came in as commissioner, it was became clear to me in the first 6 or 8 months that there is this real tension between protecting patients' rights not to be restrained and secluded unnecessarily, and protecting our employees' safety. There's a real tension. And I think that was certainly brought to light by the licensing report, which I don't know if any of you read, but was stunning, that came out in December of 2011, less than a year after I'd been commissioner, where, as commissioner, I placed Security Hospital on a conditional license. That's the most I can do without closing it down. It was a very, and if you read that report, what it said was, and most of these things predated the time, as you suggested, when I became commissioners, but some of them continued while, after Governor Dayton took office, that there was a pattern from over many years of inappropriate use of seclusion and restraints. They had some stories of what happened with patients, you know, having someone sleep on a concrete slab without a mattress for 25 days that were truly appalling. So we have had to make, to get the license in the facilities, and more fundamentally, to make sure that we are providing patients the right care, we have had to make changes in the way that we deal with seclusion and restraints at Security Hospital, and appropriately so. You don't make those sorts of changes. It is not easy to make those sorts of changes. We needed more training, and we're providing that. We needed to change the way we're doing business. And those were hard things, because what it seemed to me that that report told us is this in continuum. On one side, you need to protect patient rights, and the others, you need to check to protect employees. That is, there's a real tension between those two goals, and that we were not getting that right. And that was not serving either our employees or our clients at Security Hospital well. So we've been making a number of changes, and none of these changes, as you suggest, are easy. We've certainly changed the people who are running Security Hospital. We now have a new hospital administrator, Carol Olson. We have a new medical director, Dr. Stephen Pratt. I have great confidence in both of them. But we aren't just saying we need new leadership there. We wanted more oversight of what was going on. Are we making the changes we need to make to better protect employees and to better protect patients' rights? So that was one of the reasons that I asked Deputy Commissioner Ann Berry, who many of you all know, a longtime state employee, used to be Commissioner of Health under the Carlson administration. I asked her to directly oversee what was going on at Security Hospital and all of our state-operated services. So it no longer reports to someone. She has been going down, usually often once a week, to Security Hospital to try and, you know, be there on site to address these things. I can't tell you that this has been solved, and I can't tell you, because of the tension in those two goals, that it's going to be solved in the next 6 months, but I think things are getting better. I think that some of the reasons, and we are being much more careful about documenting when we have injuries, when we have assaults, and I think that drives some of those numbers, but I think some of it is also, frankly, Madam Chair, that we're trying different things. Some of those things are working. Some of them we found weren't working, so we changed course again. We know we have to do some things, that we have to do things differently at Security Hospital. We are trying. I think we're on the right track, but I will be the first to say that it is a long road, but it is one that I am paying personal attention to. I've been down to Security Hospital this month, and then before that, in late November, early December, can't remember which. Commissioner Berry is there a lot, and I understand the challenges that our employees face. I would say, though, as far as the psychiatrists, that yes, we had turnovers in psychiatrists, but I think one of the keys to dealing with this tension between protecting employees and protecting and preserving patient rights is having our treatment staff there more. And that is a big change we made. Too often we thought, and this is not happening now, but there are some psychiatrists that were, you know, not in the building as much. You know, and if we really want to make sure that we're having the right things done for the patients in a way that protects employees, we need to engage the treatment staff just as much as we are the nurses and security staff and others. I think we're doing that now, but that certainly took a change in approach as well. You know, I'm happy to answer more questions about this. I acknowledge it is a real challenge. We are working as hard as we can on it.
Thank you, Commissioner. When you were talking at the end about the psychiatrists and about the way the organization of provision of psychiatric services, that the psychiatrists were not necessarily on site or spending time on site, that you would draw the conclusion from that if you did a root cause analysis, one of the contributing factors that you might identify has to do with the consistency, which you need in a psychiatric setting for patients, who they're working with, who they know, they see them around regularly, that the consistency of the personnel and the relationship building that occurs around that is a part of sustaining a secure environment. So when I hear you talking about that, my head goes to, is there a thorough analysis being done as to the contributing factors as to why there is so much violence against employees? Why are the patients acting out in violent ways? Is that the frequency of that out of the realm of that general understanding of institutions such as this? It's not the only one in the world, I'm certain. And are the injuries that are occurring there that are serious, are the numbers out of line with a general population that's served in this way? What is the analysis that has been done? That's one question. And is there really a good root cause analysis of that? That isn't this kind of thing, you know, blaming one another. Then the other is, when you talk about this tension between the individual rights of persons to not be put in seclusion without proper care for too long a period of time or other forms of restraint of violent behavior against, as a tension against the rights of employees to have a safe working environment. I am asking everybody start to think about that in a very different way because it pits one against the other. And that is what the employees are communicating. They're feeling as though that's how it is being framed, that it is that the patient's rights for safe treatment are taking priority over their rights for a safe working environment. And I don't think that is what our goal should be. Our goal should be to really address what is creating the outcome and what are the interventions we need to have so that both reasonable and protective environment is there for patients. It has to be for the patients, too, but also for the people that we ask to work in these very, very difficult circumstances. And so I'm asking two questions. What have we done in terms of true analysis of what the problems are so that the way we're expending our resources are attacking that, and how are we measuring whether or not those are effective? And then what are we going to do to assure these employees that it isn't that the patient's rights, as important as they are to them, these employees care about these patients, are not at their expense of their rights to have a safe, for the state to provide a safe place for them to work. And if it means hiring more staff for a while and overstaffing in order to be able to resolve the issue in the short term till you get the long-term solution, then that's what we ought to be doing. So please take some time to respond to that. I want you to, the committee should know I'm in a district that has many, many, many people employed serving this population.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I think, Madam Chair, I couldn't agree more. It is not an either-or when it comes to protecting patients' rights and protecting our employees. I describe that tension, though, because I think that sometimes we get questions, including from our employees, you're choosing them over us, and that is not what we're about. I describe that tension because, to make my point, that it is a fine line we must walk between those two tensions to try and keep our employees as safe as possible while protecting our patients' rights. And so it was really in that spirit that I made those comments. Dr. Pratt and our hospital administrator, Carol Olson, have spent a lot of time trying to get at what is the cause of these injuries, what do we need to do differently. I mean, certainly the analysis of we really want our psychiatric staff to be spending more time on the units was part of the result of looking at what can we do differently, it's not one thing. There is no silver bullet, not surprisingly. I don't, as I stand, you know, as I sit here, can't tell you all of the that part of that plan, but I certainly know that they are working hard on it. I know when I was just down in St. Peter talking with Carol Olson, I think it was like I stopped by as I was coming back from my Mankato, not Mankato,
St. Peter,
Worthington. I was coming back from Worthington. I stopped by and talked with Carol then, and she was talking with me about her analysis on overtime, for an example. You know, and so she's making kind of additional staffing requests to us because we know that that's one of the changes we need to make. So we're really looking at this from a, what are the policies we need to, that can help, what's additional training that can help, what's additional staffing that can help. We're looking at scheduling. You know, if we have more overlap between people from one shift to another, because one of the things we'll see is that there are more problems kind of in those transitions. So if we have more overlap, does that help? Need to talk with labor about that, and we're doing that. So I think that those are just, you know, four of the things I know right now that we are looking at to try and holistically say, where are the red flags, where do the problems most occur, and where can we make changes? I must say, though, one of the things that drives this is the building itself. And, you know, Governor Dayton and I both went down, and I mean, I'm obviously there quite a bit. The governor went with me to tour it, and I think he felt as well that that we need to have a total makeover on Security Hospital. It doesn't explain everything, but it certainly contributes to both to the safety problems employees face. We have very narrow hallways, so you can't see who's around the corner. Just the layout of the stairs and the facility, you know, it's not safe. If you compare that to Anoka, to our new hospital in Anoka, where there are a lot of sight lines, you can kind of see what's going on. The nurses can see what's going on. Security staff can. Patients can see what's going on more. We have wider halls. The whole layout is much more conducive to a safe, appropriate treatment environment than we have. And that's why, you know, we're happy that we at least got pre-designed money for this in the last bonding bill. And that's one of the reasons I certainly will be pushing for more bonding to reduce Security Hospital. As I said, I'm not saying any of these things I just talked about are a total answer, but we really have to look at each of them to try and make a difference.
Thank you, Commissioner. Well, I would be very appreciative of understanding what the when a problem is analyzed in a true root cause analysis, there is a report on that, and there's an articulation of what those are, and a plan that's directed towards those. I certainly would like to see that, and I would like to know if there's a possibility that that process be certainly including the employees that are involved in this. Not simply top-down, which can happen in a large organization like this, that they're participating in the analysis of the problem, and that then there is general feedback as to the findings and what the actions are that are going to be taking place so that the employees feel heard in this process. They really are feeling, I want to communicate that to you, that that it's been repetitiously brought up here in the legislature to you and to past commissioners that this is a problem that continues to be talked about and described and acknowledged but not improved. So I'd like to I'm going to be asking about this and asking for how the continuous improvement process is going on, and as you do, wanting to affirm quality in whether it's child care systems or nursing homes. You know, these dashboards, that's our way of measuring the quality of our state-operated services. And if they aren't improving, then I think we really have to challenge ourselves as to how to make true change. Thank you. Is there anyone else that would like to ask a question? Sure, I have this to say. Is somebody willing to make a motion to move that this committee recommend the appointment of Lucinda Jessen as Commissioner of the Department of Human Services? Was there another question?
Madam Chair.
I'm sorry, Senator Benson.
I would be happy to move the appointment and approval of Commissioner Lucinda Jessen of the Department of Human Services.
Okay, thank you, Senator Benson. Is there any further discussion or questions? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. Thank you for your appearance and your responses.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
that?
It's okay.
The things you learn, huh? All righty. Next is Commissioner Edward Ellinger, Department of Health. Welcome to the table and to the committee. Commissioner, we'll turn the microphone over to you for whatever comments you'd like to make, and then open it up for questions.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to come and speak with you. My name is Ed Ellinger. I'm Commissioner of Health, or have been Commissioner of Health for the last 2 years. I come here from a member of a family of 10 children, from parents, working class parents. I'm married of 43 years, have two adult children and four grandchildren, ages 3 up until 12. And I've worked in a variety of places throughout this country, working particularly with low-income and high-risk families. And I think about my parents and my siblings and my daughters and my grandkids and the kids that I've worked with every day when I come to work as commissioner, because I think that's who I'm working for, to really improve the health of kids and families and communities throughout this country. It's ironic that actually 40 years ago this year, in 1973, I was driving through Minnesota on my way from my internship in Pennsylvania to a stint doing rural health care in Montana with the National Health Service Corps, when I stopped at a wayside rest on 94 and picked up a Time magazine that featured Wendell Anderson on the cover saying, "The Good Life in Minnesota," as he was holding up a walleye. And at that point I thought, you know, as I read the article thinking this might be a good place to come and work someday, it looks like this place has their act together and it's a good place to live. It's ironic now, 40 years later, I'm before you, seeking your confirmation as Commissioner of Health. During that 40 years that I've been in healthcare, I've worked in a variety of settings throughout the country, in rural and urban. And it took me just about 6 months in my first clinical practice in Montana to realize that I could be seeing patients every single day, being very busy, and I would never really totally change the overall health in a community. That the issues in the community were sort of overwhelming the medical care piece. I could certainly save and help a lot of individuals, but the overall health status in that community wouldn't be affected by that. So I learned at that point, after not having thought about public health in my medical training, that there had to be a different way, and public health percolated up in my consciousness as a place to do that, because it focused on the health of populations, the health of all people, not just the one individual at a time. And public health embraced this continuum of services from prevention to early identification, treatment, and rehabilitation, that all of that was part of the continuum of care that really needed to be present if we were going to really improve health. And I also realized that public health recognized the social determinants of health. It was not just our healthcare system that really impacted health, but it really was the environment, the housing, the transportation, the things that people live amongst and with that really impacts their health along with their medical care. And so I started to include public health into my clinical practice wherever I could. And when I worked for the Minneapolis Health Department, really integrated the medical care and the public health piece as I worked with families in the city of Minneapolis for 15 years, and realized the power that integration of medicine and public health really had on the community. And took that also to Boynton Health Service at the university. You know, it's a sort of a city in and of itself, where Boynton Health Service was the primary care provider, but was also the public health agency and was also the financier of health care for students. And recognized that with that community engagement of the students and providing that broad range of service, you could really make a difference in the overall health of the population, but also in the health of each individual. And also I recognize during all of this time that most of the attention, though, goes to the medical care piece, to the direct service delivery that goes on in doctors' offices or hospitals. And what happens with public health is really pretty invisible to most folks. And it reflects in how our healthcare system is funded, where we spend about 95% of our healthcare dollar on the treatment aspects and only about 5% on public health. And yet the data show that about 80% to 90% of all of the determinants of health really are not part of healthcare. That only impacts about 10%. The rest of it is behaviors in the environment and the social conditions and individual behaviors and genetics. So I brought all of those things to my practice. So when Governor Dayton offered me this position 2 years ago, I was really honored and pleased, and I have thanked him several times since that time for taking this, for giving me this opportunity. I did not know Governor Dayton prior to his asking me to be health commissioner, but I was impressed by the fact that he was really looking for somebody who was steeped in public health, who knew public health, because he really wanted to have an impact on the overall health and wanted best science to do that. And so I was pleased that he offered me that position. And I took the position because I think this position gives me the opportunity to learn all that, or put to practice all that I've learned over those 40 years in health and public health and medical care to help make Minnesota the healthiest state in the nation, to really get back to what was on that cover of the Time magazine, this is the good life in Minnesota. And I think we have an opportunity here that is unparalleled among any other state. We have a good history of public health, and I believe we have the best medical care system in the world. I think we have the highest quality, the best access, and the best value. And we have a history of public health that is also stellar in this country. We were the third state to have a public health agency, a state public health agency. But we're not reaching our maximum in terms of our health because we have not invested over the last 20 to 30 years in public health the way we've invested in medical care. And I think that's where the opportunity lies, and the opportunity that I would like to really pursue as Commissioner of Health is how can we really have a balanced investment in medical care and public health so we can take advantage of all the best that medical care provides, but also all of the opportunities and potential that good public health has. So coming to the department, I've been working hard over the last couple of years on a whole variety of things. One of the things that has been most pleasing to me is the fact that the Minnesota Department of Health, with its 1,200 employees, is really staffed by a large number of people with a lot of expertise in a lot of areas. I think some of the content experts in the country reside in the Minnesota Department of Health. But not only do they have expertise, but they're mission-driven, and they are really dedicated to public service. And it's been just a pleasure to work with them, and certainly they have been a big part of what the department has done, and certainly I contribute any success that I have with the partnership that I have with the staff and of the Minnesota Department of Health. And I just wanted to go reflect back on a few things that have happened over the last couple of years that I think have been quite remarkable and kind of speaks to the quality of the service and the impact that the department has. One of the very first things, actually before I became commissioner, just before I became commissioner, the Supreme Court had a ruling about our newborn screening program. One of the core factors in our public health, core component of our public health program. So just after coming on board, we really had our staff work, certainly with the legal folks and with the legislature to really try to revamp our newborn screening program so that it would protect patient privacy, protect patient parents' rights, but also continue to protect the health of babies in our state. And I think we came to a really good solution that protects that program, saves, really impacts the health of 150 to 180 newborn infants every single year in this state while protecting individual privacy and parental rights. So I think this has been a wonderful thing. We've also been able to continue the cervical breast and cervical cancer screening program for the department, serving about 17,000 low-income women throughout the state on an annual basis. We've done a lot of work in the whole area of nutrition. We've initiated the Great Trays food program, where we've changed the diet and the menus in schools throughout the state. So again, a collaboration, and you'll hear this over and over again, that public health is a lot about collaboration, working with the Department of Education to change the program so that we've changed the diets in schools for about 570,000 children in the state so they have better access to fruits and vegetables and healthy foods. Developed a lot of farm-to-school programs, which not only has improved the diet within the schools, but it has been a good economic development throughout our state, where farmers now have a market for their food, and we're able to maintain farmers to maintain their farms and their programs. Develop 160 farmer markets over the last couple of years within the states, again, probably which would not have happened without our involvement. We've also been recognized as the number one state for electronic health. And this is something that comes out of the Minnesota Department of Health because it's part of the quality initiatives that we have. How do we work with the medical care system? We don't do direct service, but we oversee the quality and the access and the kinds of providers that are there and electronic communication. And we've been working hard on this. So we have more people who have advanced electronic health records in the state. We're the number one state for e-prescribing, which is something that's very crucial, both to reduce cost and improve quality. We've also been able to work on getting 31 post-secondary education campuses tobacco-free. Again, one of the leading public health problems in our country, tobacco use, and with our work with local communities and with post-secondary education institutions, have had 31 campuses go tobacco-free. As you heard earlier on, we were influential in getting the dental therapist program and the community paramedic program up and running with a lot of work with our workforce development unit. National models, and they just had the American people from across the country, Pew Foundation came to Minnesota to really look at the dental therapist program as a model, as a way of improving access. We've been doing a lot of work on worksite wellness. We had 870 employers initiated worksite wellness programs over the last couple of years that have had a tremendous impact not only on the health of the individuals in that workplace, but also on their families. And certainly we've responded to emergencies. Emergency preparedness is one of the things that we've been working on over the last 10 years, and in the last couple of years, we've been able to really put that preparation to good work with the floods in northeast Minnesota, and certainly have used that to respond to the severe influenza epidemic that's going on right now and the whooping cough epidemic that we've had in this state, and also the norovirus that is plaguing us. So we've done a whole lot of things, and I think one of the things that we don't have numbers to show, but I think we have also raised the issue of health disparities, has made it part of the conversation in conversations through all of our work through the department, but also in our work with other agencies, and certainly in health reform, where we've really talked about a lot of the work that it needs to be done to improve health disparities in this country, and particularly in this state. So those are some of the things that we've been working on over the last couple of years, and I'm proud that we've made a lot of success in that. But I also, in looking ahead about what needs to be done, I also decided that I would make some trips throughout the state, and like Myron Franz with his three-legged stool going to various parts of the state, I put on my knickers and took my horseshoes and went to various counties throughout the state, from Goodhue County to Clay County and from Freeborn County to Beltrami, doing Pitch the Commissioner. And I know a couple of you probably have also already received one of your little horseshoes. It seemed to me a good public health thing to do where you don't have to go on a golf course to do business. You can do it over a horseshoe pitch, and it's a lot easier and it's a lot cheaper and doesn't take as much time. But while I was there in these counties throughout the state, really listening to your constituents, ask them, what do they see as necessary in this state? What's the health department doing well? What could we do better? What could the state do? And I heard lots of interesting things that I think are really informing what I'm going to be doing over the next several years. But it's also pleased to know that what I was hearing also conforms to what the data are showing about what needs to be done. I heard a lot about that reducing health care costs was important because they're paying a lot, particularly a lot from employers. But they really wanted to pay for quality and value, not just for services. And certainly that's one of the things that we work on with our provider peer grouping and our quality measures that we're really looking at value. They want to maintain and strengthen the public health system. Certainly the community agencies that work in the area of public health, not just governmental public health, but the field of public health, recognize that there's a need to have strong state and local public health agencies there to work with. They really want to have access to primary care, not just hospital and specialty care, but really primary care, particularly in our rural areas. And in their definition of primary care is dental care and mental health services that need to be part of primary care. This is, again, something that we'll be working on. They also want healthy and livable communities, recognizing throughout the state, people do recognize that where they live matters to their overall health, to their overall quality of life, and they really want to have those investments in that. And they want to invest in what keeps people healthy. They really do recognize the fact that we can't treat our way out of health problems. We have to do some prevention. So they really are looking at what's keeping people healthy in their communities. And I hear, again, throughout the state, the whole issue of health equity, that there are, as we become an increasingly diverse state, that there are disparities that are affecting everybody in communities. There's racial and ethnic disparities, and I also hear about the geographic disparities that are there that really have to be addressed. And I think about that as I think about what it takes for us to be the healthiest state in the nation. As we become an increasingly diverse state, we need to deal with health equity, health disparities, if we are really going to reach that status of the healthiest state in the country. So what I'm hearing from individuals throughout the state and what the data are telling us from our own research and the public health research, that we really need healthy people in healthy communities with a healthy healthcare system. And that's what I will be working on for the remainder of my time as health commissioner, really, really working on the maintaining that strong public health infrastructure. 25 of the 30 years that we've increased longevity over the last 100 years has been because of public health initiatives. And it's the health protection things. It's the clean water. It's the infectious disease control. It's the healthy foods. It's the good sanitation. It's the healthy environment. It's tobacco control. And yet, we're lowering our investment in that. We need to continue that investment in some of those the health protection services, because those things never go away. The infectious diseases are always there, and we have to maintain surveillance on those. The tobacco industry, despite all of our efforts, isn't going away. They're still spending $22 to $24 million a day trying to get young folks to start smoking, so that we have to continue that health protection activity. So I'll be working to really try to improve the health protection, to get support for the health protection activities. That's why I was really pleased that the governor included a tobacco tax in his budget, because I think that is one way to enhance that health protection activities. But I also think we now need to start focusing on the health improvement piece. As I mentioned to this committee, we do health protection and health improvement. The health improvement is really the vaccine for the chronic conditions, for the obesity, the diabetes, the heart disease of the 21st century. We don't have a pill, we don't have an injection that will overturn those risk factors and those diseases, but we do have an intervention. It's the health improvement things related to SHIP, the statewide health improvement, where you change policies and systems and the environment that support healthy choices, that make healthy choices the easy choices. So that's, we'll be really working on that. And again, I'm pleased that the governor has put in his budget allowing the SHIP program to, again, go statewide, because this has been one of the most powerful public health interventions that I've seen in my 40 years of public health, because it's based on best practices. It focuses on community engagement, community ownership of it. It works across disciplines. It's got work sites and hospitals and health facilities, local public health and education, and the business community really working collaboratively on making health thrive in those communities. And it really changes behaviors and changes some of the policies that are there. We will also be working a lot on public health, our workforce, public health workforce, and healthcare workforce, medical care workforce, particularly among primary care. The one place in our medical care system that really interfaces most easily with public health and social service is primary care, and yet we underinvest in primary care. Of the $8,000 that we spend per person per year on medical care, only about 250 of those dollars go into primary care. That's the place that you can actually save money, you can improve quality, and you can improve outcomes. And it's the place where you can integrate with the medical care, the public health, and the social services, that as I look around the country and look around the world, that's where you get the biggest bang for your buck, you get the biggest outcomes for the community. So we will be working on workforce issues, trying to find ways to make sure that we get that's why MRC funding, loan forgiveness, will be things that I will be working on to try to get the right kind of providers and get them in the right places so that they provide the kinds of services that are absolutely needed in our community. And then finally, we will be embedding health equity in everything that we do within our activities and our services, because I think we're going to have to think about dealing with health equity in new ways, because what we've been working on over the last 30 years with improving health equity has not been working. Yes, we have our Eliminating Health Disparities Initiative, which I think really works in targeted areas, but we've not taken those to scale. We've not found a way to really change our total approach to dealing with health disparities. And I think, and we will be doing that with our partners. So this is not just something that Department of Health has to do. This is where we partner with education and human services, corrections and transportation and housing. All of those, we have to work together on disparities, because all of those social determinants that I mentioned earlier are going to be really crucial to that. So we, I think over the last couple of years, we've really helped to change the conversation about health. I'm hearing a lot more discussion about the need for prevention, need for moving upstream, that if we're going to achieve the triple aim of improved population health, improved cost, and improved consumer satisfaction, we're going to have to take a public health approach. We're going to have to do prevention. We're going to have to move upstream, because that's the only way that we're going to be able to reduce costs and improve population health. So I've been honored to be a commissioner for the last couple of years. I've been honored to work with Governor Dayton, who's been a good supporter of public health. I've been honored to work with the staff of the Minnesota Department of Health and our partners throughout the state in local public health, and private sector, who are working on the same kinds of issues that I am to try to improve the health. And so I look forward to, I hope, working with you for the next couple of years, and I'm open to any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Commissioner Ellinger. Are there any questions from the committee?
Senator
Benson.
Commissioner Ellinger, I was wondering if you could take a few minutes to review something that happened fall of 2011, I believe it was, when a hold was put on some grants and you advised the governor on a letter that brought up that actually stated that a senator's actions were unconscionable and would severely harm 5,000 children, and what we found out that it was really just a data withhold. And I'm wondering if you could take a few minutes to address that.
Commissioner Ellinger.
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, back in the fall of 2011, when we had some federal grants that were that we had received grants from the federal government that needed legislative approval to go through the Legislative Advisory Committee, met with Senator Hahn to go through those and explained what those the impact of not having those funded would be on various things, because there were a variety of grants, and worked through the impact that not having the funding would have. And certainly the funding for the cancer surveillance would affect the individuals. You know, I believe it was 5,000 at the time, or I can't remember the exact number. And if not funded, it really would have an impact on it. The words that were used in the governor's letter were the governor's words. We just tried to stay with the data to try to say what actually impact it would have. And on a population-based level, we know that it'll affect a large number of folks. It may affect individuals differently, but on the whole, by not funding that cancer surveillance program, would weaken the program and have an impact on the health of a large number of children.
And
Senator Benson.
Madam Chair and Commissioner, the 5,000 children are the total enrollees over a 20-year period, and the delay in the data was from 6 months, reducing it to about 4 months. And so you're saying the governor went out on his own saying that it was unconscionable and would severely harm 5,000 children if their data was delayed for 2 months?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator Benson. As we looked at the time frame, we were not as precise as we should have been on the time frame of making that determination, and we were not as clear as we should have been. I will acknowledge that in terms of the kind of impact that we would have. Because there were several ways of looking at it, and I don't have all of the details in front of me right now. We probably didn't choose the clearest way of expressing the kind of impact that we would have over a 5-year period.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Ellinger, you mentioned quality, and we've often talked about quality, how important that is for us to measure outcomes and quality. And I wanted to see if you could visit with us a little bit, tell us a little bit about quality measurement in healthcare and what is our goal with that, and then you know, how can we get that measurement and make it so it's something meaningful for the customers. Can you discuss that a little bit, please?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, quality has been a focus of the healthcare system at least as far back as 2008 and probably more in this state. But in 2008, the legislature really wanted us to focus a lot more on quality and particularly wanted to get to identify quality and value so that purchasers could purchase high quality care and high value care, not just the cheapest. And so several things were set up. The Minnesota Community Measurement, which really works with clinics and providers throughout the state to get input on a variety of indicators that they choose over the course of the last several years, things like diabetes and hypertension and a whole variety of indicators that they really want to measure to see where people are in terms of best practices and are they getting the best care. We take those data and match them with the cost to really come up with a value construct to say, well, how do we get the best value or the best outcomes for the lowest cost? And we have a program called Provider Peer Grouping where we take those data and we compare hospitals on a whole variety of those indicators to see which ones have the highest value, with the idea of getting the data out so that people can make some choices of which plans to buy, which providers to go to. But also, most important for me is you get those data to the providers themselves to see how they're doing relative to their peers. Quality measurement and measurement of value is an evolving program, and with provider peer grouping in particular, we've been learning as we go along. And when I came in 2011, I really withheld the public reporting of provider peer grouping because I was not comfortable with the methodology that we had. I was not comfortable with the currency of the data. We were using a data set that was fairly old. And so I think these are very powerful tools, so I really wanted to withhold using those data for purchasing purposes, but I did want to get the data out to the providers for quality purposes so they could change their behaviors. So we, with the help of the legislature, put together an advisory committee that is now looking at all of those indicators and the methodology, and we'll be revisiting that very shortly in the next month or so to get out the provider peer grouping. So the whole purpose is to systematically measure quality indicators in clinics and hospitals throughout the state, analyze those, and then able to do some comparisons so that providers can learn from what they're doing and what others are doing, and that consumers can make good choices about which plans to purchase.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you. Just a quick follow-up. Thank you, Commissioner. As you're looking at retooling that provider peer grouping, what are your thoughts about there's such a wide variety in providers. We have wonderful community hospitals that we want to keep accessible to our population. We also have specialty care clinics and tertiary care clinics. And how do you look at the quality amongst that continuum of different providers?
Madam Chair,
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson. You know, with quality, it's provider peer grouping, and we really are trying to figure out, what are the comparisons that should be made? What are the things that should be the same everywhere, whether you're in primary care or secondary care? But also when you start having a difference between, the hospitals, large hospitals and the some of the critical access hospitals, are they really peers? So what are advisory committee is helping us do to try to find what are the best indicators and make sure that we have the best indicators and the best way to identify those. And then we risk adjust, trying to make sure that we're comparing apples to apples and oranges to oranges, but then also to determine what are the appropriate peers to compare with. We're still in the process of doing that. We haven't come to the final conclusion on that, but that's how we would risk adjust, make sure that we're comparing people treating the same kind, same difficulty of patients, the same risk patients, but also then trying to find what peers to compare with.
Thank you. And just a follow-up comment.
Yes.
I appreciate that, and I note specifically, and we want to make sure that we continue to have our the best quality health care at the best value and the best accessibility. Minnesota truly does lead the nation in that regard, and as we move with our provider peer grouping, our exchanges, I think it's important that we all that we maintain those best quality value and accessibility. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, Senator Nino.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Benson is so nice and congenial, but I'm going to try and make this a little more obvious to those that may be watching what she's talking about. Both Senator Benson and I were here in this room when we had a hearing on the particular issue or concern on that grant. I believe it was a grant, relatively small, a grant for some cancer research. And Senator Hann, as chair of the committee, had put a hold on that after meeting with the commissioner. Hope that's not me. Meeting with the commissioner and staff. And the reason Senator Hann held that overview hearing was because he felt that the commissioner and staff had given him one message and gone back to the governor and with something different. Now, I wasn't in that meeting. I didn't know. So I came to that committee hearing with an open mind, thinking that it clearly could have been simply a miscommunication. However, the way everything played out and the way that the answers were given and not given and the written justification that ultimately was provided to the committee, Senator Benson talked about, that it would affect 5,000 children, it became clear to me that some message was given to the legislature via a committee chair, and a different message was provided, and efforts were coordinated with the governor in what clearly to me looked like a purely political act. The justification that was provided to the committee was a joke, really was a joke, that somehow delaying data for a few months would affect 5,000 children over 20 years. We're talking young children. So delaying data by a few months would somehow affect children that wouldn't yet be born for a decade. Really?
So in the context of what you're describing, Senator Nino, is there a question?
No, Madam Chair, more of a comment, and certainly the Commissioner is more than I'm more than willing to let him have the last
word. Excuse me, perhaps my question wasn't clear enough. I'm okay with a comment, but the comment, if it's just a reviewing of something, if there's a comment of a course or a direction that you're seeking from the department, I think that would be helpful.
Madam Chair, my point is, and I'll go back to my previous comments with Commissioner Jessen, I think appointments are presumptive, barring a disqualifying event or act. To me, when the legislature is given information, and different information is provided to the administration to put them at odds in what appears to be a political maneuver, to me, that is a disqualifying event.
Okay, thank you. Senator Hayden?
Good. Thank you, Madam Chair. I wasn't going to weigh in. I was here as well as at hearing, and so I just kind of caution us, and in particular Senator Nienau, to be careful when you make those kind of statements. I'm not sure that we can prove that Commissioner Ellinger said one thing to Senator Hann and said something else to the governor or staff. It appeared that way from your vantage point, but it's not something that I know is proven. And so I want us to be careful as we kind of use those strong words, that we're careful about what really happened. And I know I wasn't in the room for either meeting, and so I was at the hearing, and I didn't necessarily think that Commissioner Ellinger has said anything than what he's told this committee on the record. I don't know if there has been a conversation with the governor or his staff that has said that Commissioner Ellinger told us one thing and told Senator Hann another, and so I want us to be careful as we kind of come to the point of accusing Commissioner Ellinger of saying two different things or lying to the committee. I just think that we're in dangerous ground when we kind of start those accusations. I firmly believe what Commissioner Ellinger has told us, what he said, and then what the governor and what the governor's staff might have taken from that in terms of the communication that they gave back to Senator Hand is exactly what he said. Until someone can tell me otherwise, or the governor himself weighs in to say that there was a difference in opinion, or there was a difference in the message, or a difference in what he said, I think we should be careful, Madam Chair and Senator Nenow.
Are there other questions?
I will close with my question then. As you know, I really appreciated the overview that you have given us on several occasions. I believe the Department of Human Services has an important role in providing services, access to health care as they need it because they can't afford it, or access to housing, or a variety of social services that will help them sustain themselves, especially if they're impoverished in this society. But the Department of Health really has an important role in keeping us healthy and engaging in those activities that we should do collectively to ensure improved public health activity. And I am concerned and I'm happy that the governor in his budget is looking at increasing resources for the SHIP program, and that the overall expenditures in the state for that which will prevent disease continue to be increased and not be the subject of the chopping block each time we run into some difficulties, because it is the real investment that will change this trajectory that we're all talking about. So I'm very encouraged that you are here, that you were selected because of your strong belief in public health and in the investment in public health programs. So it's just a fabulous choice. The other thing that you talked about is the role of the Department of Health in relationship to protecting public health. And as you know, one of the initiatives, besides all of the reforms we have for what we pay for quality improvements, for early screening, that we need the department to tell us which of these screenings really creates a good outcome and which doesn't, what's worth investing in and what isn't, so we aren't spending our money unwisely. But also, when we do take initiatives that attack those root causes, those excess or deficits that drive a negative health outcome, like smoking, and we engage in an activity that is a difficult and statewide initiative like the Freedom to Breathe Act, that the department, when they're given the responsibility of overseeing that and managing and making certain that it is implemented thoroughly as intended by the legislature, that you and your leadership position call upon the people in your department to do that. And I just would like you to speak to that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I will speak to that, but I do want to respond first to the data issue. Data are very powerful, and that's one of the things that the Minnesota Department of Health has, is we have lots of data, and we use it, and we have to use it judiciously and appropriately, and we try to be as transparent as possible. What I learned from the episode in the past, that we were not as clear. I don't think we were being duplicitous or being purposely unclear. Our messaging was not as clear as it should have been, and we learned very clearly that with powerful data, we have to be as clear as possible so that people can, you know, make the appropriate decisions around that. We have pledged to do as clear as messaging as possible, but there's always ways that data are used in a variety of ways. So that's when the discussion has to occur, so be open to that. As far as tobacco continues to be the number one public health problem in our state and in the country. And we will, I'm pleased that the governor has again taken it on, both through the SHIP program, which allows us to look at tobacco control, and also by increasing the tobacco tax, which will help keep people from starting and others, incent them to quit. In terms of enforcing the Freedom to Breathe Act, we've been able to do a fairly good job throughout the state and been great compliance. Certainly some things have started to raise their heads as people trying to get around the Freedom to Breathe rules. And I know one in particular, the hookahs, have been one that we've had some struggles with. And I know my staff has been working with you in particular, Senator, to come up with some ways that we could enforce this way in a way that I have the authority to do that. I always have to balance out what authority do I have given in state statute, or what rules do we have that I can follow to make sure that I'm committed to recognizing tobacco as one of our number one public health problems, and will do the best I can to enforce those laws to the extent that I can do that.
And I appreciate that, and I just am hoping that enforcement can of an agency can be timid or it can be certain, and to the full extent of your ability to do that, and I'm asking you to be to lean towards the certainty side rather than the cautious side. And I also want to say in conclusion that in terms of data, that I don't think that there's anybody among us that hasn't figured out that sometimes when we present data, there's always the possibility that it's an incomplete presentation. There's always the rest of the story that maybe creates a broader understanding or clarification of data that wasn't included in a comment that we made. And simply because not all is included doesn't necessarily mean that something deceptive or deceiving was intended. Okay, with that, is there anyone who is willing to make a motion? It's listed on your agenda. Senator Marty. Senator Marty moves that the committee recommend the appointment of Edward Ellinger as Commissioner of Department of Health be confirmed. Any further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Say aye. Those opposed?
Nay.
Thank you very much. Your name will be forwarded for confirmation.
Thank you very much.
And that concludes the business of our committee.